welcome to the 50th edition of the Awful Announcing Podcast. This is Matt Yoder, and today we welcome back our very first guest and one of our more popular guests, the co-author of Those Guys Have All the Fun, Jim Miller, to talk about the layoffs at ESPN and many other stories emanating from the world in Bristol. It's coming up on today's AA Podcast. With this, our 50th podcast, we invite back to the show the guests on the very first Awful Announcing Podcast, our most frequent guest, one of our most popular guests, certainly the one and only Jim Miller, the best-selling author of Those Guys Have All the Fun, the expert of ESPN. Jim, welcome back.
Too kind of an introduction, but thank you.
Well, let's get to now your news-breaking hat this week on Twitter. You can follow Jim at ESPNBook and a few stories that you dropped. Let's start with a big one, and that is Keith Olbermann joining Turner. You got out in front of, I think it was the Hollywood Reporter and Turner's own press release there, joining TBS for their MLB coverage. From what you know, how did this come about, and was there any interest from ESPN in possibly bringing back Olbermann?
Well, Keith actually, you know, was at Turner early on in his career, and I think that a lot of people spend time thinking that Keith burns bridges, but there are still people who are big fans of his. And when it comes to baseball, look, this guy is unreal. He is encyclopedic. He has a passion and a love for the game. I had about a million stories that I could have used in the book about him writing Mickey Mantle's obit and doing other things about baseball at ESPN that are just mind-numbing. So I totally understand why Turner would want to bring him back, and I think it's going to be great for baseball fans. Regarding the ESPN part of the equation, look, I wrote a piece for the New York Times, I guess, a couple of months ago about conversations that he's had with John Skipper and others at ESPN about coming back, and I'm not quite sure that that book is closed. In fact, I think it's still open. The nature of Keith's deal with Turner is that he's going to be involved in the postseason, but I think there's a lot of opportunities still up in the air, and quite frankly, there are people at ESPN who do want him back. There are people that don't, but that's a smaller group, and look, it's up to John Skipper. But I know that Skipper had a very nice dinner with Olbermann, and they had a great conversation, and so we will see. But I think for baseball fans, it's going to be great for Keith to be back on the air.
His deal with TBS is very much on the short term, it seems like. To me, Jim, it all seemed like MLB Network may be the best fit given Olbermann's passion for baseball. So if you looked, you know, maybe long-term, where do you think Olbermann may find a home if he does indeed make this permanent return to sports? Did you see him at ESPN maybe after this run with Turner? Could you see him sticking with TBS or maybe an MLB Network type situation if you had to gaze into your crystal ball?
Well, look, I mean, I think all three are viable opportunities, and I wouldn't be surprised if, I mean, right now he's dating Turner, but I think that he's going to have to marry somebody, or somebody's going to, you know, need to marry him in terms of getting a longer, permanent, more, you know, arrangement in place. I'm not quite sure. Look, I can't predict what's going to happen at ESPN because it is a cultural battle, and there are people who are, you know, in Skipper's ear who are talking about, you know, you can't let him come back. You can't let him come back because they're remembering, you know, certain things that happened from 1997. But there are other people who are just saying, look, this guy is really, really good. He brings in viewers. He knows his stuff, and we should move beyond that. So it's a very interesting thing to look at for Skipper in terms of, you know, Skipper's own decision-making process.
Another story you had on Twitter this week was Kirk Herbstreit signing a huge 8-year extension with ESPN coming up in the near future. What does that time commitment say about Herbie's position on the pecking order there in Bristol?
Well, it says two things. First of all, obviously, he's incredibly important to the network now. They love him. They don't want him to go anyplace else. But the second thing that's kind of more interesting to me is that it shows the paradigm shift that John Skipper has instituted in terms of college football and the length of these deals that ESPN is making with places like the, you know, SEC deal was 20 years. So I don't think that Skipper is in the business has any interest in making like a 3-year deal with somebody that he knows is really, really good for the network when he's got huge commitments with various conferences running, you know, close to a decade. So I think that this really cements Kirk's place. And the interesting thing that happens now is Brent Musburger is not going to be around for the next 8 years. He's going to probably retire. And who gets that job? That is a coveted job. That is a big, big job. And who is going to be next to Herbie? That's a sweepstakes that I think is going to be a lot of fun to look at.
Would you have a prediction right now? I mean, you've got Nestler, you've got Sean McDonough, Joe Tessitore has got some fans online with his college football work. I mean, could you throw out a name that you think may be the front runner at this point, or is it just too early to tell?
I don't think there is a front runner. I think you've correctly thrown out some of the more legitimate and notable candidates. Here's the great thing, though, about having Kirk on board now for this long term. You can actually sit down with him. You can say, who are you going to feel most comfortable with? Mm. These are some of the people we think, you know, you can try people out. You can try and start to engineer a deal, but it's going to be, that's a big decision, and it's going to be probably one that will happen within the next 12 months.
All right, now the major ESPN story of the past month has certainly been the layoffs in Bristol. From your networking, from your sources on the ground, people you've talked to, what has been the reaction and the fallout to those layoffs from the rank and file there in Bristol that measured in the hundreds?
Right. Well, the first thing is, I think we got to give a little bit of context to this idea, because when companies lay off, when enough layoffs, so they're laying off 300 or 400 people, it's a contrition. They're talking about slowing down. They're talking about eliminating jobs and getting rid of people. In a way, ESPN is doing that, but they're not stopping hiring. It's one of these kind of strange paradoxes. They are eliminating jobs, but I think what's happening is they're becoming more efficient. They're increasing their productivity. They're eliminating jobs in certain areas where they don't need them anymore. But I'm telling you, it's not like there's a hiring freeze at ESPN. It's not like they're slowing down. It's not like they're becoming less aggressive. They are going to be as aggressive as they've ever been, if not more so, with Fox coming on this summer, NBC doing what they're doing, CBS doing what they're doing. They're not slowing down. So it was a tricky thing. In terms of what the rank and file think about it, it's very complex, because you have ESPN spending billions of dollars on rights and yet at the same time having to eliminate 300 to 400 jobs. So there is, in a culture, let's face it, the last time that ESPN had to go through cuts of any kind was during the recession back, I think, in 2008. And so this is not a place that is used to this. And so it does set the culture on its end. It does create uncertainty. It does create resentment. And it's unfair to those people. But at the same time, they're trying to run a business, and they think that this is the way that they're going to become more efficient.
You mentioned the billions in rights fees, and that was tossed about as one of the reasons to the layoffs. Where do you see this discussion? Because I know this is one of the big topics on our website about rights fees and about this supposed cable bubble. As the prices and the subscription fees go up, as new networks like Fox Sports One, like the SEC Network come on that are going to ask more and more from consumers. And there are some folks out there, and I think it's fair to say an increasing number, that are saying, you know what, I don't need cable anymore. I'll survive with online streaming. I'll survive with Netflix and Hulu and get by. Do you see this sea change ahead in the industry that ESPN and these other sports cable networks are preparing for? Or is this supposed bubble just a mirage off in the distance?
I think it's a lot easier to hang out and cord cut, hang out with Netflix and Hulu if you're not a sports fan.
Yeah.
If you're a sports fan, you want to experience live sporting events, which I think 96 or 97% of viewers of sporting events like to watch them live, you're going to need that delivery system. That's not to say that ESPN is going to continue to enjoy the sub fee increases that they've enjoyed over the past 15 years for the next 15 years. I don't think that's possible. But what I do think is that there are enough sports fans and there are enough people who really want that kind of inventory coming into their house where they're not going to, they're just not going to eliminate it. I think that most of the studies prove that out.
I know this may be a little bit inside baseball, but one of the fascinating parts of your book was how key those subscriber fees were to ESPN's incredible rise over the last couple of decades. I think it's over $5 now that they pay, and you see some of the other sports networks are less than $1 per month per subscriber, of course. So how important are those fees to ESPN? If you can't just take us inside, just the separation and the gap there between ESPN and these other networks that are trying to play catch-up, and how difficult it's going to be for a Fox or an NBC sports network to do so, lagging so far behind ESPN in that category?
Right. Well, let's talk about in the world before Fox and NBC and others got into the cable sports business. If you were to have taken a fourth grade class back in 1995, and just said to them, okay, here's a company that gets its money from subscription fees and advertising revenue, and here's some networks that they only get their money through advertising networks. Which company is going to win in the long run? I think most of the fourth graders in that class would have gotten it right. I mean, the amazing thing is, though, that the market didn't get it right. There was 20% in 1990. Whenever I think about this, it just blows me away. But in 1990, 20% of ESPN was for sale. Cap Cities didn't want to have the whole chunk of it, and they were desperate to get rid of 20%. KKR had given it up, and the only reason Hearst wound up buying it is because they had a tax certificate that basically reduced the cost, and they wanted to, you know, do something nice with the ABC affiliates. That was it. I mean, the place is making over $10 billion a year in revenue this year. It's crazy that no one understood the model back then the way they should have. But if you fast forward now to this increasing number of cable competitors, it's true, ESPN's about 5.25 per house, and it's not going to be possible for Fox or others to get to that number. But the truth is, they don't have to. I think if you really break down the numbers, if you look at Fox, if Fox can get 85 cents or $1 a sub, that's going to be a pretty winning formula for them. I mean, nobody has to compete with ESPN toe-to-toe in order to be successful. There's a lot of ways to make money for your shareholders without going and doing exactly what ESPN is doing.
Mm-hmm. We'll get back to Fox and NBC and the landscape in a bit, but I want to talk about the new ombudsman, Robert Lipsight. Lipsight's a respected name in the industry. Maybe that label isn't even doing him justice. I know you and I both contributed to a column at SI about his upcoming tenure, and hopes are high for him and that role. How much will Lipsight's credibility help ESPN with presenting to readers, to viewers, that they are trying to be more transparent, and how much weight will he give that ombudsman role?
Yeah, you know, I mean, those are really interesting questions, and I have to tell you, I'm going to, you know, pull up a ringside seat and enjoy watching this one. There's a couple independent variables at work. So, first of all, how independent is he going to be? I mean, knowing his reputation and his legacy, you would think that he's going to be awfully independent. So it may not matter how many times, you know, executives take him out to lunch or how they may try and influence what his agenda is. I think he's a pretty strong, independent voice, so that's encouraging. The second part, though, is what will be his focus? Because originally, when he got the job, they started talking about he's going to be focusing on journalistic conflicts. And the truth is, and I wrote this for the SI thing that we both participated in, ESPN has gotten pretty good at monitoring themselves with these journalistic conflicts. They used to be poor. It used to be a problem for them. But I think that they've gotten much better at it. So as a result, I don't think there's enough for Lipsight to do just to monitor those.
Yeah,
There's so many other things that he can be writing about and filling us in on that I just hope he expands beyond that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point because, you know, if we would have had this podcast last year, Jim, we would have been talking about front and center a lot of those journalistic questions that we've raised with their reporting, with their sourcing issues, maybe even conflicts of interest with the rights and covering those leagues and conferences. But now you see there's a clear policy for reports on television. I'm not seeing the doubt on my Twitter feed or comments that ESPN is stealing reports from other outlets. I think that's something that Bristol is finally taking seriously. So I wonder what direction Lipsyte will go, because I think the one thing with Poynter, and maybe the biggest criticism of their work as the ombudsman, was that there wasn't a lot of relevancy. They weren't talking about topics that really meant a lot to readers and to fans and people who are watching this stuff. So it does maybe open the field to Lipsyte. So I wonder if he'll maybe take on the Skip Baylesses of the world, if he'll take on, let's say, the daytime sports center and the TV stuff, or where he might go. So it'll be fascinating to see which direction he goes. Maybe it'll just be a potpourri of all of those.
And which may not be bad. I mean, look, when you're the ombudsman for ESPN, you are swimming in the deep end of the pool. It is a visible job. It is a job that has an incredible, I mean, the people who pay attention to what the ombudsman writes, they have a voracious appetite. They want it early. They want it often. And one of the things that Don Allmyer did, Don Allmyer was a great television mind, and he had interesting things to say. But the problem was that he didn't do it often enough for basically the clientele, so to speak. And as a result, sometimes when he would write things, even though they were incredibly well-reasoned, they were either, it was too much, you know, too much time had passed, or other things had been written in between. And there were some, you know, other issues going on with Don at the time, so he couldn't be maybe be as productive as he wanted. But the truth is that Lipsyte, I think, I hope, will step up to the plate early and often and get some of these things in a wide range. There's so much. Look, you and I both know this because we love following ESPN. There's so much going on in ESPN every day. 7,000 employees, 8,760 hours of television a year. There is, you know, over 1,000 people on air that they have arrangements with. So there's a lot to write about. There's an enormous worldwide brand that has to be examined continuously. So I hope his agenda is really just like this huge Sunday buffet, and he doesn't stick to one thing.
Bouncing around talking several ESPN-related topics on today's 50th AA podcast with the man who knows ESPN inside and out, Jim Miller. John Coblin published a lengthy piece yesterday at Deadspin about the legal issues from the sordid Steve Phillips-Brooke Hundley affair that represents maybe the messiest chapter in ESPN's recent history. You were quoted in that piece. What did you make of it, and has the culture gotten any better in Bristol? There were a few really damning quotes in there about the work environment, especially for women. So the continued fallout from that Steve Phillips saga and how ESPN has changed over the last few years, has the culture there improved?
Well, first of all, I mean, in terms of what I thought about the article, look, Coblin did the Lord's work. I mean, that's going through those court records and reporting like that. He's a very good reporter. He's written some very interesting things about ESPN, so my hat's off to him. Look, this represents a dark chapter for ESPN and the people involved, and you almost feel like taking a shower after reading the article because it was so difficult for so many people, and you know, so many people got burned as a result. What I'm delighted by is that David Burson, you know, not only survived but has excelled afterwards. He's the new president of CBS Sports. Katie Lacey has a fantastic job. They're happy. You know, and I do think that it had, as I said in the end of the article, I think it had a profound effect on the ESPN culture, something that's still probably part of its DNA now. And you go through something that big, and it stays with you for a while. But I'd like to think that the efforts of Skipper and lots of other people have made things better since then, and you know, we hope. Look, I think that there are less, what we used to call in the old days of Deadspin, there's less Deadspin material coming out of Bristol now than there used to be. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a credit to the efforts that ESPN management has undertaken.
Let's move to ESPN's coverage of the NBA Finals quickly. One personality that's going to be a big voice there is Stephen A. Smith, of course. I think if you turn on ESPN or ESPN2 at any given time of day, there's about a 50% chance you'll see Stephen A. And it's amazing to me because of his rise and fall and rise again at ESPN. It's almost like after Bristol parted ways with him a few years ago, after he got oversaturated, the network somewhat came back to him ideologically, where he would be a good fit once again. And it's not like ESPN is more tailored to Stephen A.'s maybe loud persona. Can you explain how he came back to ESPN and this second tenure in Bristol that has seen him take on a larger role, and what his appeal is within Bristol?
Well, like you say, I mean, Stephen A.'s relationship with Bristol reads like an EKG. I mean, there have been moments of Mark Shapiro, he was the poster boy and he was all over the place. And then he got to a point where I think his act wore a little thin on executives and there were problems. He thought he should be paid a lot more money than he was being offered, and they parted ways. One of the unsung heroes, I believe, in this whole saga is Rob King, who is a great executive at ESPN, has a fantastic reputation, just a smart, well-reasoned guy who loves journalism, has great journalistic roots. And I think that it's fair to say that there was some mentoring that Rob did. I don't know this firsthand from Rob, but I heard it from several people, more than several people, with Stephen A. And I think he helped get him back into the fold. And it's clear that they love him again. I mean, like you say, you cannot go. It seems like this morning, I mean, he was on every 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
He's really risen again. The only problem is that when Stephen A. is by himself and he's talking and he has, you know, passion for basketball and he's great with opinions, that's fine. If you want to start putting him with Skip, though, every single day, and I mean, we could talk for days about First Take and whether it has a deleterious effect on the ESPN brand or not, but I think that that's when you start to make Stephen A. almost like a parody of himself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Jay Farrow and everybody at Saturday Night Live start to say, hey, listen, you know, this is just too delicious not to, like, make fun of or parody. So I think that they have to be careful, because you start to kind of hit diminishing marginal returns on that kind of, you know, shtick.
How is Simmons' role continuing to evolve at ESPN, and will we see him back on the NBA pregame show next year?
I think, look, Simmons gets better all the time. He doesn't have a TV background, and I think that this has been, his learning curve has been quite evident this season, because the truth is, he's better this month than he was last month, and last month the same before that. So I think that this has been a really positive year for Bill. The problem with Bill is that he's got this kind of like empire that he's created with Grantland and with his own column and with 30 for 30 things that he's involved in. And so there's a bandwidth question. It's like, literally, how much can he do? He's also married. He's got daughter that he's just bringing to a hockey game. I mean, he's got a life. So I think that one of the things, the short answer to your question is, I actually think it's Simmons' decision, not ESPN's management. If he wants to come back, I think that they will have him back. I'm just not sure he's going to be prepared to sign up for an entire season again of with as much traveling and with as much work as he has to do for that show.
I know we're reaching close to the end of our time, but I want to ask a couple brief questions about the general landscape and returning to Fox and NBC, CBS, all these competitors to ESPN. With Fox Sports 1 launching in August, what do you make of their positioning and the seriousness of their attempt to take on ESPN, given Fox's history and really success in network TV, in cable news, in reaching the top of those areas? Now they're going to take on ESPN with this sustained 24/7 cable network with Fox Sports 1. Do you see this being the strongest campaign to take on ESPN directly?
I don't know if it's going to be the strongest, but I do know that they're quite serious about it. They're throwing serious dollars at it, and they should be taken serious. They should be taken seriously. This is not something that you think, well, you know, it's just going to kind of come and go. They have some very interesting inventory. They have some very interesting rights. They have there are a couple of major deals coming up that they could play a big role in securing, that they could actually, you know, get because they have some deep pockets. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
NBC Sports Network came out with a lot of hype originally, but Jim, it seems like that network is almost content being a niche network with the EPL, with Formula One. We've talked about some of their rating struggles. We've seen them miss out on some major rights acquisitions. Are they content kind of being that second, third, fourth option?
Well, I don't know if they consider themselves that. I think that they have great broadcast properties. What they do with football and what they do with the Olympics is probably unparalleled. And I think that they're, you know, figuring out this the cable part of it. Steve Burke is an amazing executive, and he actually, in the early parts of ESPN's life, he was actually on the ESPN board. He knows cable programming. He, obviously, with Comcast, he knows cable programming in general, but he knows a lot about cable sports programming, so I'm not sure that that story is fully written. I just know that this summer, it's going to be interesting to see how Fox jumps out of the gate, because they've been spending some serious money on talent, but they're also spending. I mean, I had a couple ESPN production assistants and others tell me. I mean, people who are making like $50,000 in Bristol are being offered, you know, 80 and 90 to go to Fox. So they're throwing around some interesting numbers.
You mentioned David Burson, a former ESPNer who's being promoted to president of CBS Sports. How do they fit into this equation? CBS Sports Network lags behind the others in terms of distribution and viewership. We've seen them lose the U.S. Open tennis rights to ESPN and basically sit on the sidelines for a lot of this arms race that's developing between ESPN and NBC and Fox with these 24/7 cable networks. Will we see CBS be more assertive, or will they continue to pick their spots?
I mean, look, you have three really smart guys, Les Moonves, Sean McManus, and David Burson, you know, running that place. They're not going to, it looks to me like they're not going to make stupid financial decisions. If somebody else had done that MLB package without the set fees that ESPN has, they probably would have lost at least $150 million, $180 million on the deal. What I think you're seeing is that there's a discipline at some of these competitors that they're just not going to spend funny money just in order to have inventory against ESPN. ESPN is on an entirely different plane when it comes to financial abilities. They're going to bring in over $6 billion just from sub fees. So that gives them the opportunity to spend money in a different way. I think David is going to be creative about how David and Sean, they're going to be creative about how they spend their money, but they're not going to be in a mad rush just to spend lots of silly money just to be able to say that they have something. Because if they can't monetize it properly and they can't develop a financial model that makes sense, then that's not going to be a happy move.
Terrific insights, as always. Another great chat with one of the must-follows on Twitter, at ESPNBook, reporting insights, information from inside Bristol. The great Jim Miller, the New York Times bestselling author. If there's actually any listeners that haven't read Those Guys Have All the Fun, please go out and buy it on Amazon. A great book, and certainly worthy of all the praise it's received. Jim Miller, thanks for joining us once again. Always a pleasure, and hope we'll catch up once again soon, maybe on the 100th edition of the Awful Announcing Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, and happy 50th.
Our thanks to Jim Miller once again for joining us on the AA Podcast. Such great insights, as always, on ESPN and the sports media. The man who literally wrote the book on ESPN, Those Guys Have All the Fun, and definitely an entertaining and informative follow on Twitter, at ESPNBook. You can catch him in the New York Times. He's co-authored a few pieces with Richard Santamir and has a three-part series coming up this summer at the New York Times, so definitely keep a watch out for that. That'll wrap up our 50th edition of the Awful Announcing Podcast. And on a personal note, I have to express some gratitude to all of our listeners who have stuck with the AA podcast. To be honest, this was started on a whim a couple years ago when we were granted an interview with Jim in the lead-up to the release for Those Guys Have All the Fun. And since then, we've been able to interview some of the biggest names in sports media, from Michelle Beadle a couple times to Ian Dark and David Faraday to the voices of the NHL Stanley Cup Finals and NBA Finals, Doc Emmerich and Mike Breen, Kevin Harlan, who calls the Super Bowl on radio, some of the biggest names and announcers, analysts, reporters, writers that have been guests on the Awful Announcing Podcast, and hopefully we'll have even more guests as we begin the march to the 100th edition of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I never quite thought that we'd stick around for 50 of them, but I definitely appreciate all of you that have listened in and hope that you'll stick around for the next 50 Awful Announcing Podcasts. As we always do, a bit of a promotional roundup for ourselves just to pay the bills. Give us a follow on Twitter at Awful Announcing. Like us on Facebook. Sign up for our newsletter. And you can catch all of our podcasts by going to iTunes and searching the Awful Announcing Podcast and by subscribing there at the Awful Announcing homepage. As always, most of all, thanks to you once again for listening. We'll see you on the 51st edition next time. For now, this is Matt Yoder saying happy trails from the Awful Announcing Podcast.